Pepsi, Patel is described by various British sources, including Wikipedia, as Eurosceptic. She was a leading figure in the Vote Leave campaign for Brexit during the 2016 referendum on UK membership of the European Union. Reports indicate that following Cameron's resignation, Patel supported Theresa May's bid to become Conservative leader. May subsequently appointed Patel Secretary of State for International Development. However, Patel's breach of the ministerial code in 2017, when she was involved in a shameful political scandal involving clandestine meetings with Netanyahu and fellow regime leaders in the occupied territories, ended her tenure. Though the unauthorized conduct of holding 12 separate meetings during a family holiday to the occupied territories without notifying the foreign officer Downing Street had disgraced her, Boris Johnson ignored Patel's violations by resuscitating her political career. That the controversy surrounding her turbulent political career would expectedly have cushioned responsible leaders, Johnson chose to cave into the pro-Israel lobby by deploying her in one of the most powerful cabinet positions. In making this outlandish move, Patel has selectively chosen to remain silent on the fact that Hamas, having engaged in Palestine's political process and won the legislative elections in 2006, was rebuffed by the British regime. In doing so, the UK defied and denied the political choice made by Palestinians. As expected, Hamas has expressed its shock and dismay at the move. It called on the government to apologize for the Balfour Declaration, which illegally set the stage for the creation of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine in 1917 during the month of November. The statement added, "The Palestinian people, backed by the Arab and Muslim nations and the free people of the world, will continue their fight for freedom and return at any cost and will not be discouraged by those who failed to support them. We are confident that the Palestinians will fulfill their aspirations for freedom and independence sooner or later." Given the fact that Hamas espouses Islamic values and that its defense of Masjid al-Aqsa is profoundly admired, it is widely believed that the overwhelming majority of Muslims across the world support it. Britain's 4 million-plus Muslim population would be no exception to this. It goes without saying that solidarity with Palestine's freedom struggle is intertwined with support for Hamas. But by Patel's decree, Muslims and millions of British citizens of various faith groups found to be pro-Hamas will face criminal charges and the prospects of long-term jail.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about one outstanding decision from the side of Iraq's most prominent Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who insisted on its state of neutrality concerning the makeup of the Iraqi future government. We know that they're establishing a new government in Iraq now, and the people have voted for that. But Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani stated of neutrality in that part. Said Mohsen Naqvi, let's start with you this episode. Why do you think Ayatollah al-Sistani decided such a decision?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, we can see the main role of Ayatollah Sistani, that he has the role of a leadership amongst the Iraqi nationals, basically. And we can see the way he have saved his nation from the threat of ISIS.
That's right.
You know, when he gave the fatwa of everyone should come out and they need to protect themselves and they need to come out for Iraq, basically.
That's right.
And the Sunnis, his fatwa about the Sunnis, that they are just like our body parts. Yes. They're just a part of us, basically. That's what he had. So basically, he is, his status is above all these political, we can say, you know, the fights or the differences that, yes, we can see within the political groups. And actually, in Islam, when we look at the Islamic system, within the Islamic system, we have the system of Imam and Ummah, like, yes, the leader and the followers, basically.
Yes.
Under this system, which is the basic system of, we can say, Islam, and especially in Shiaism, we follow this system. Ayatollah Sistani is playing the role of the leader at the moment for his nation. And when he's playing the role, then there is no grouping for the followers. But obviously, we are following a secular system where we have this democracy and, you know, these political systems, right and left, I don't know, the Republican and the other ones. So the decision that he made is a wise decision.
Yes.
And those even who are criticizing him basically are unknown to what he is capable of, basically.
That's right.
And they want him to get involved in the little things, little, yes, issues,
yes,
that they have in between them, which can be solved by the political,
right,
we can say, groups by themselves.
Okay.
And there is no need of him supporting anyone.
That's all right. And especially when we look at the country Iraq, see our Sunni brethren also living over there, you know, and Ayatollah Sistani has always emphasized on the unity among different denominations inside Iraq and all the Muslim lands, and that's why he had made an international figure regarding from the Shia world in Islam. But Said Murtaza, again, you know, this is when, you know, out of the total seats of the, we can say, the parliament, in the parliamentary elections, the Shia ones have won the chairs over there. And Ayatollah Sistani is a Shia, so automatically and technically speaking, it was expected from Ayatollah Sistani to support, you know, the Shia ones over there. But he has stated neutrality, again, not getting into the political games and the political scene of Iraq. But at the same time, behind the scene, he has this power of issuing a fatwa against ISIS and Daesh and all the people from different denominations, not only the Shia and the Sunni, but also the non-Muslims come to the scene following him. So this is the power of the Marja'iyya in Iraq. Talk a little bit about this for us.
Well, you know, we have to just again look into the issue of election from two different point of views.
Okay.
First, we know that election looks like a political game.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone involved in the political game puts his political purpose first before any other factors. And we know that Muslims around the world have the same system somehow these days, that they are very much involved in the political issues. And election is one of them.
That's right.
As a kind of election expert, because I used to work with election commission in some countries in Africa and in Asia.
That's right.
I would like to say that the election is a technical process. We have technical campaigns. We have political supports from political parties. But the story looks a little bit different inside Iraq, because I was actually somehow involved in the election for the first time that took place after that Saddam Hussein as a dictator toppled.
Okay.
So we have this constituency election. We had this constituency election there.
Yes.
You know, we should not forget the great influence and the role of Shia authorities. And this great Marja inside Iraq is not going to belittle himself and his role as the only leader who is going to bring the whole nation together when the situation is getting tough.
That's right.
And we had this actually done by Grand Ayatollah Sistani.
Yes.
And, you know, political game is not a ground for scholars to play.
Yes.
So what they did was a great achievement for the Shia scholars.
Yes.
Because basically we need to look at the bigger picture. What stands more important than anything else inside the country?
Yes.
National integrity and national unity.
Yes.
So if these two factors have been kept and they have been actually maintained,
yes,
especially by a religious scholar,
yes,
it would certainly give this interpretation to every single individual in the country that the whole nation is together,
yes,
and they are not going to be divided.
That's right.
Let's look if the other things would happen.
Mm-hmm.
If this Grand Ayatollah would actually take a side in the election, so the whole nation will actually fall apart.
Yes.
So, and the system probably will collapse.
Okay.
So in order to prevent more damages, greater damages to the national interest and to the even to the religious interest.
That's right.
So I think great Ayatollah al-Sistani made a great decision.
Yes, that's
and
right.
He and his office openly announced that they're not going to take any sides,
yes,
but they're going to actually look at the whole election
right.
process that must be fair.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, we have actually different segments,
yes,
political segments,
yes,
in the country that each won some seats.
That's right. Okay. And Said Mohsen, do you think that this decision of Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani will make a kind of religious unity among the Sunni and Shia inside Iraq too?
It is definitely. Obviously, we have these different groups. We should not forget we have Kurds, we have the Sunni denomination, we have the Shia denomination. And as Said Murtaza has mentioned, the scholars, they should not enter into the political, you know, games that the politicians generally have, the groups have, because they come with their own personal, we can say, like, inclinement towards, you know, the thoughts that they have.
That's right.
They have their own plans. And tomorrow, if something goes wrong, the very first person who's going to be blamed,
yes,
is not the political,
yes,
party. It's going to be the Grand Ayatollah.
Yes.
So it was a wise and great decision that he made. And obviously, this will bring unity. And tomorrow, if anything happens or any, we can say, like, if there is a dispute among these parties, Ayatollah Sistani will be the one who can solve these issues the way he did before.
Okay.
You know, obviously, we need to leave a space for someone who can resolve the issues
That's
amongst
right.
the political parties if tomorrow, if something happens and the Iraqi nation needs someone.
Mm-hmm.
So basically,
why is this independent reasoning for himself?
Yes.
You know, on presence.
And
okay.
This is a big decision because tomorrow they will not go after America to come and do decision, make decision amongst us.
Yes.
They have their own personality, they have their own leader, or a Grand Ayatollah who can basically make decision for themselves. So yes, it is the matter. It will bring a unity amongst all the communities, and obviously it increases the respect of the Shia school of thought as well.
That's right.
That when such a person at a high state of a school of thought, he plays a role neutral in the election where everything should be neutrally, should be resolved neutrally according to the process which has been defined. So therefore, the unity will increase and the respect amongst the people will increase definitely.
That's all right. And this, as you said, from the side of the Hausa of Najaf, and you know, the Zaim, the main Zaim of the Hausa of Najaf, you know, and all the Shia houses inside Iraq comes, that is Ayatollah al-Sistani. You know, this position has shown that, again, Ayatollah al-Sistani is emphasizing on the national unity and the integrity of Iraq. And as you said, in the harsh decisions that are made, for example, the attack that ISIS made on Iraq, you know, such a personality can really help the people over there. But say, Murtaza, the case is that the Shias inside Iraq are now getting the chairs out of the parliament, the majority of the chairs out of the parliament. But again, they must not be proud of this power. Is it so? because in the next elections something else might happen. And I think this power shift inside Iraq and the balance has to be taken care of, because the population over there is not the only Shia one.
Well, you know that if you look at the primary results of the count, you would see that the whole ballot papers have been counted, and the political parties, usually the three major ones, won some seats from this election.
Yes.
And the only political party that won actually like two-thirds of the seats were the Shiite ones.
Yes.
And it shows that the majority of the people, the majority of the eligible voters actually voted for the Shiites.
That's right.
So it shows that it's a great opportunity for the Shiite political parties, not only one, because we have another political Shiite political party that won around 37 seats.
Yes.
So altogether, it's more than like 100 seats,
yes,
and it was allocated to the Shiite political parties.
Yes.
It's a great opportunity. It shows that Shiites must take this opportunity and use it in order to benefit the whole Iraqi nation. And,
right.
You know, in Iraq, we have other religions too,
yes,
other followers too.
Yes.
We have even Christians.
Yes.
We have other
yes,
followers of other religions. So Shiite must draw a very authentic picture of religious freedom.
Yes.
Unfortunately, religious freedom is not a popular term in Western parts of the world. So they say we don't have religious freedom. But what has been happening in some countries like Iraq now, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and some other countries, we have religious freedom.
Yes.
So this freedom must be practiced.
Yes.
And I think Shiite political parties now has that chance, and they have to grab that chance and to show to other followers of other religions that Shiites are not very much closed-minded.
Yeah,
so
even inside Islamic Republic of Iran's parliament, we have representatives from the Sunni Brethren, from Zoroastrians, from we can say the even the Kalimi ones, you know, the Armenians, you know, they have their own representatives inside our parliament inside Iran.
So this shows that the Grand Ayatollah Sistani made a very effective decision, and his role is not going to be ignored in order to increase, advance, boost national unity and national integrity.
Okay, Said Mohsen, any comments?
Well, I just wanted to add that, you know, when we see Ayatollah Sistani being neutral, we should, when we're talking about the election of the Iraq, we should also have a neutral role, or maybe let's take out this discussion from the sectarian, you know, discussion, from a general discussion that the Iraqi nation had election.
Yes.
There are some parties, you know, obviously the parties, maybe they're like Shia and Sunni. We are just saying that, but I think it's not good to mention Shia and Sunni.
Really?
Well, a party has won most of the votes because, you know, if you look at the population, Shias are in majority.
Yes.
So if we say like they have won more seats, and what about the Sunnis? This is not good.
Okay.
Basically, in Iraq, there's a special like party which is related to the Sadr family.
Yes.
There are the other parties which are related to other tribes. Because another thing in Iraq, we have this tribal system as well. So basically, if we put forward this word as that most of the, you can say like the votes or the seats have been taken by the Sadr tribe, and this party has taken it, that would be better, rather than saying if Shias are coming, what's going to happen, or Ayatollah Sistani is Shia, because, you know, the role and the statement of Ayatollah Sistani tells us or teaches us that you should not use such words, because you should use a word which tells that within Iraq there are two parties, and a party has got more votes, what he can do.
But any group, regardless of any, we can say,
sectarian
look that we have, if comes to the power, has to observe the rise of all in
That's
Iraq, whether being
important.
Sunni or Shia one. That's right. Okay, this is the point. Thank you, my Said Mohsen and Said Murtaza, for presence in the program Viewpoints. We talked about Grand Ayatollah Sistani's decision on its state of being neutral concerning the makeup of the future government in Iraq. It was very kind of you, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Shia and Khalaf Islam page. Also, YouTube channel and Instagram page, Khalaf Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parsetoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
During the Vietnam War, the U.S. military engaged in an aggressive program of chemical warfare codenamed Operation Ranch Hand. Now, from 1961 to 1971, the U.S. military sprayed a range of herbicides across more than 4.5 million acres of Vietnam to destroy the forest cover and food crops used by North Vietnamese. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange, which contains the deadly chemical dioxin, was the most commonly used herbicide. It was later proven to cause serious health issues, including cancer, birth defects, rashes, and severe psychological and neurological problems. But the Vietnamese were not the only ones affected. U.S. soldiers unknowingly brought the legacy of Agent Orange back home. Join us for this week's Aperture as we meet three children of U.S. veterans who fall victim to Agent Orange and follow them as they travel to Vietnam to face their demons. Here's the first part.
All I ever heard was war stories about how horrible it was and how violent everything was and that there was just death and destruction, and that's the picture that was painted in my head of what Vietnam was. And it scared me half to death when I was getting ready to come over here, to the point where I was actually shaking on the plane on my way here because I did not know what to expect.
Traveling here, someone said, you know, Heather travels back to the land of her father's demons. Vietnam is still a very scary, dangerous place to them.
I was actually very nervous and very scared. Several of my father's friends kind of scared me about some of the things that I may see and hear and experience. Their vision of Vietnam was a war-torn, angry place.
Have any bottled water before we get going, just in case.
My name is Josh Kelly. I was born on August 18th, 1975.
My name is Heather Bowser. My maiden name is Morris.
My name is Rachel Harding. I was born in northern Indiana near Chicago.
My dad was Daniel Kelly. He was in the U.S. Marine Corps, and he fought in Vietnam.
My parents had married 9 days before he had left for Vietnam. They said that, you know, if they had 9 days being together, that's what they wanted to do.
My father got his draft papers when he turned 18 and chose to marry my mother before he left. They got married, and 2 weeks later, he was deployed to Vietnam.
I've been trying to find out what exactly happened when he was there, because when I was younger, I tried to block the stories out because some of them were so scary and so so violent and all that that I just tried to not even listen to them because I didn't want to hear it because they scared the bottom of me because I was just a kid.
When they came home, they wanted to put the war behind them. The Vietnam War was a very difficult political time, civil rights time, and so wanting to put it behind them, start their family, and move on.
As soon as he came home, they chose to wait to have children. They waited about 7 years before they decided to try, and I was the firstborn.
So my mother had two miscarriages. She lost two children, and no one in our family had had any kind of problems in that respect, so it was very unexpected. And then in 1972, my mother was pregnant again and felt that she had gone into labor early. She was not due for a while. They went to the hospital. She had already lost two children, so she was very scared. She thought she might be miscarrying again at a very late time in the pregnancy. They rushed her into the hospital, and she said, I'm in labor. And she was very thin, and they kind of said, no, you're okay. It's okay. You're going to be all right. You're not in labor. You barely look pregnant. She was 7 months along at that point. My mother woke up to my father sitting at her bedside telling her, and it's hard to talk about, but he said, Sharon, she's damaged. And that's what she woke up to. So I can only imagine how scary that was.
The doctors, as soon as I was born, they took me from my mom, and they put me in a little incubator, and then they rushed me off out of the room. They didn't explain anything to my mom. They just said that there was problems.
Various doctors approached my mother at different times and asked what she had done to her child. What had she done to cause such terrible problems?
They brought her over to show me to her for about 5 minutes, and then they put me on an airplane and they flew me to another state, and they kept me in the incubator, and they put me in intensive care, and they had all kinds of doctors looking at me and checking to see if I was going to live or die or what the deal was, because missing my arms and my leg, they weren't sure what all was wrong with me. They started to take me to the doctors and stuff out there, and because they were big hospitals and there was lots of doctors from around the world and everything, they wanted to try a whole bunch of different surgeries and stuff that were like experimental surgeries that nobody had ever tried before. Like, one of them was that they wanted to grow my arms back, and the way that they were going to do it is they were going to cut the skin open, break the bone, and then they were going to drill holes through it and put screws in it and put plates to separate the bone, and the bone would grow in between the gaps. And they said that it could take up to 5 to 10 years for my arms to finish growing back, and that it would be an extremely painful.
I want to go back to real quick to one memory I had in kindergarten. We were learning about our hands. This is your left hand, this is your right hand. And it's always a memory that I kind of laugh about. I love school. I couldn't wait to go to school. I was so excited. I wanted to read and do that stuff. So we're sitting in this circle, and the little children are sitting there, and I can just remember this to this day. And there was like a board on the floor, and it had a picture, an outline of a hand and another hand. And each child was to go around and take their turn and say, this is my left hand, this is my right hand, this is my left hand, this is my right hand. And so I remember just being anxious and excited to do my turn. And I went to put my hand in, and I just, at that moment, I was like, oh, okay. Because they had the outline, and my fingers didn't match the outline. And I was like, okay, this is my left hand, this is my right hand, but they don't look like that left hand and that right hand. And that was kind of like, okay, I'm different. That's different.
Pretty much all my life, as far back as I can remember, I knew I was different because I was always going to the doctors, and I would always see the other kids playing and stuff, and I couldn't really go play with them because I either had doctor's appointments or they didn't want anything to do with me. Or
I have lost 19 children. I never carried more longer than 8.5 weeks, and I would lose my children. I have hypothyroidism, the infertility issue, and psoriatic arthritis. Those are the three biggest ones that I have that affect my life personally. And my family could not understand, my father included, could not understand, where did this come from? Nobody else in the family's ever had this. How come you're suffering from this and nobody else ever has?
I've seen lots of different kids that had disabilities and stuff from being like in the hospitals and stuff all the time, and some of them are so similar that it would have to be from the same thing. The similarities in our disabilities are so much alike. There's no way to deny that it was the same thing that caused both of them.
These are the structural formulas for 2,4-dichlorophenoxyacetic acid, commonly known as 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. From these chemicals are made a large number of closely related compounds, which are sold commercially for weed and brush control. The Secretary of Defense initiated a project to determine whether visibility in troublesome jungle vegetation in the Republic of Vietnam could be improved by aerially applied chemical sprays. In that country, jungle growth, swamp foliage, and roadside vegetation retains its leaves the year round. Consequently, it affords ideal concealment to guerrilla terrorists who sporadically attack the free people of Vietnam. As a result of these tests, defoliation spraying was placed on an operational basis. Those chemicals already proven most effective as defoliants will continue to be used until faster acting types.
So my father says that, he said that there was spraying of his base pretty regularly. I found out since that his base was practically sprayed every day, and that is also due to its proximity to Benoit. Benoit was the epicenter of where Ranch Hand worked out of. So if they had anything left on their missions, they came around that area and used it. The perimeter was hand sprayed, aerial spraying with the C-123 planes.
My dad was in the U.S. Marine Corps. He was stationed in the Chu Lai Air Base, and while he was there, he was exposed to lots of Agent Orange. They sprayed it on everything. It was in the food, it was in the water, it was on their clothes, it was on the plants, it was on the guns, the ammo, everything had Agent Orange on it. So he was heavily exposed to Agent Orange.
North Vietnam charged today that defoliants have produced many instances of miscarriages, congenital defects, and monstrosities among children.
As we anticipated, the Vietnamese doctors that we've met with very much share our concerns about the effects of Agent Orange.
Although that war was long ago, there is lingering anger about the United States' use of a controversial defoliant spread by American aircraft on the jungles there.
Milton Ross, a special forces advisor near Pleiku, has a son born without the tips of his fingers.
Frank Moore is nearly dead from cancer. He thinks the cancer was caused by chemical defoliants he was exposed to as a soldier in Vietnam.
my dad explained to me about how dangerous the stuff was, because it would kill off big old trees and everything in just a couple of days. He would tell me the stories about how he would have to mix it, and he would have to load it into the tanks, and he would put the tanks on the planes and the helicopters and everything while he was in the war.
It's still causing trouble, and all of the people that have lost their lives to Agent Orange, and this is kind of where it began. So it's very sad.
We found out that the rate of miscarriages, fetal death in utero, and birth defects are 4 times higher than in the exposed, among the exposed, than the non-exposed. We have carried out some more studies, and now very sure, certain that toxic chemicals cause many things to my people, to the exposed people. Cannot deny it.
Yes.
Cannot deny the relationship between dioxin with the abnormal outcome of pregnancy among the exposed people.
After the war time, I mean, after 75, his dad came back here and they have the first child. But due to the Asian race, she or he died after 10 days. The biggest one, I mean, the biggest child of the family is a normal child, because he was born before the time that the dad came to the army.
But do you know in America who carries the pain of Agent Orange? The veterans who serve. The veterans feel responsible. Our fathers felt responsible for us. Even for in Vietnam, I mean, they felt responsible. The soldier, not the chemical companies or the government that made the decision.
So my father felt extreme guilt. He felt like he had caused my birth defects. He had told my mother that every time he looked at me, he felt that it was his responsibility. He had caused this to me. And that's a major problem in the United States, trying to work through the Agent Orange issue, is that the veterans feel extreme guilt.
The man that my mom knew from the time she was four did not come home from Vietnam. He's still wandering around in the jungle somewhere. He came home a very angry man, very sad man.
My dad was suffering more and more from his PTSD. He was having other health issues, and he was getting weak, and he couldn't do the things that he could do before, and his health was just going downhill.
Thank you.
the light.
Robots now helping as teaching aids in some Korean kindergartens. The pint-sized machines do everything they can, from singing to reciting stories. The robots, being as tall as nearly 25 centimeters, can also dance, have sing songs, and even teach kung fu moves. That gives children fun as they mimic the robots' push-ups and one-legged balances. It's also good for the kids' creativity. In fact, that's the purpose of sending the robots to hundreds of kindergartens in Seoul, beginning from August. Each robot has a camera and its helmet, making it possible to take photos and send them to a tablet for viewing. Teachers say they love their new ways.
The robots are helpful when at times it's hard for me to read everyone's stories. The robots can read out stories in a very entertaining way by switching voices accordingly.
For now, the robots are being used as part of a pilot program, but Korean education officials hope to use them more widely, although they say the machines would not replace teachers. The officials believe having this experience in nursery schools will have a lasting effect throughout the kids' youth and as adults.
Spacecraft are used for a range of purposes, from observation to exploration and navigation. But this specific spacecraft was designed for a totally different purpose, to smash into an asteroid. In a first-of-its-kind mission, NASA launched the vehicle, Dot Dot, from a Space Force base in California. The mission will take 10 months to travel to a pair of asteroids. It will eventually crash into one of two rocks and see if it can change its course. Just before impact, DART will deploy a small satellite to take photos of the crash. Space organizations around the world are eager to find ways of countering objects that might head towards the Earth. The good news, though, is that for now, none of those objects are a threat. Old manuscripts are precious and can sometimes fetch attractive sums of money, but this one has gone far beyond, as it's a really rare handwriting belonging to a world-famous scientist. This manuscript was sold for a whopping $13 million at an auction at Christie's in Paris, but would you still be surprised if we told you that it belongs to no one but the great physicist of our time, Albert Einstein? Einstein did not have a habit of keeping drafts, and this is one of only two manuscripts that have survived. Einstein wrote the 54-page document in the early 1900s in Zurich, Switzerland, and his colleague Michel Besseau has preserved it since then. The document contains Einstein's preparatory work for his signature achievement, the theory of general relativity. Einstein's letters have set records twice before, but for much lower prices. November is the best time of the year to see polar bears moving around Canadian shores. During this month, the carnivores gather in large numbers and wait for the waters to freeze before they begin their seal hunt. These bears are playing and wrestling in the Canadian city of Churchill, dubbed the polar bear capital of the world. The area is located within a natural habitat of a large population of polar bears. Sometimes the city's residents even share their streets with these animals. Currently, there are nearly 25,000 polar bears in the world, and Canada is home to more than 17,000 of them. However, wildlife organizations say these animals are facing the threat of extinction by the end of the century due to global warming. Ro- robots in a war-ravaged city. Androids serve clients in a restaurant in Mosul, an Iraqi city that still bears the scars of a years-long presence of terrorist groups. This fully digital eatery offers a futuristic experience to its customers. From interactive tables to glowing constellations, everything seems like a journey to the future. But the robot waiters are the stars of the show and the major reason the restaurant attracts a large number of visitors every night.
The idea started during the COVID lockdown. As you know, people spent most of their time on social media during that period, since commuting was not allowed. So we tried to look at different ideas from around the world, and thank God we were able to execute this idea and complete this project.
The owner of the eatery says he has imported the robots, but other technologies used there are the work of a group of young engineers from the University of Mosul. The venue has already become very popular, and many visitors call it their favorite place in the city. Qatar displays a dazzling drone show as it unveils the countdown clock for the 2022 FIFA World Cup in Doha. The clock, in the shape of an hourglass, is located at Doha's iconic Cornish fishing spot. The distinctive design enables the structure to be seen from any angle and stand out from the spectacular city skyline behind it. The event reveals to fans worldwide that just 1 year to go to the big kickoff. Famous athletes including David Beckham and Samuel Eto'o were in attendance at the ceremony. They may not realize it, but they are extremely lucky. Two pandas have been adopted by superstars. Chinese Olympic champion Zhang Jiechi and Paris Saint-Germain footballer Kylian Mbappe have become godparents to a pair of panda cubs. The athletes have both expressed satisfaction with their new role, with Mbappe calling his godparenthood a big moment. The cute cubs are only 3 months old and can barely stand on their own feet. They are called Yuan Dudu and Huan Lili. Space lovers have been treated to an epic lunar eclipse that dazzled the night skies of the Northern Hemisphere. The event is also known as the Blood Moon because of the red haze seen around the moon during the eclipse. The 3.5-hour phenomenon gave stargazers the chance to witness the longest partial eclipse in 580 years. Although NASA calls this celestial event a partial eclipse, around 97% of the moon was cast into a red hue by the Earth's shadow. A total eclipse could also be seen in Russia's far eastern regions. The next longest partial eclipse will take place in around 648 years.
An 11-month-old baby has become an internet sensation after a video of her snowboarding went viral in China. Wang Yuji is a daredevil infant snowboarder whose adorable face sticks out underneath all the protective snow and sports gear. Her parents decided to learn skiing during the winter, but they also wanted to include their baby on the fun of snow sports. While snowboarding might be a bit too early for a toddler who can barely stand or walk, Yuji was not scared at all and even enjoyed it. China, which is hosting the Winter Olympics in a couple of months, is encouraging citizens to try ice and snow sports.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Every year, the roads across this tiny island in northwestern Australia turn scarlet just as millions of crabs leave their homes in the depths of the forest and start marching together all the way to the ocean where they can mate and spawn. The spectacular group voyage on Christmas Island happens after the first rainfall in October or November. And in order to give these red creatures the leeway, locals close off multiple roads across the island. They've even built a special bridge for the crabs so that they can cross the road unharmed. The mesmerizing migration is now a tourist attraction, drawing nature lovers from around the globe.
Paleontologists in Brazil have discovered remains that could belong to a species of dinosaur as yet unknown. The fossils were found at a site in northeastern Brazil. A team of scientists is trying to put together the bones and complete the huge dinosaur's skeleton. They think it lived during the Cretaceous period, which began around 145 million years ago and ended with extinction of all dinosaurs roughly 66 million years ago.
A new study shows that moderate consumption of tea and coffee may be better for your health than previously thought. The study conducted by a Chinese medical university says tea and coffee can help keep stroke and dementia at bay. And if you're wondering what is meant by moderate consumption, it's defined as something between 2 and 5 cups of tea and coffee, either alone or combined in one day. The study followed more than 360,000 people aged 50 to 74 for over a decade. Some scientists have praised the study as robust. Others, however, say the participants were all selected from the UK Biobank, which means they're healthier than the general population. Pomegranate has a special place in Iranian culture. There is a trace of the fruit everywhere from poetry to cooking. Iranians even hold a pomegranate festival in the fall. This year the event is held in one of the main parks in the capital, Tehran. The festival features different varieties of pomegranates that are grown across Iran. The visitors can also find pomegranate products, including juices, concentrates, and dressings. The event includes cultural parades, music concerts, and traditional live performances. Iranians say they always welcome the pomegranate season, as it's one of the old symbols in the country's literature and art. The Christmas season always brings happiness and joy to people around the world. Many Parisians these days are taking a respite from their daily routines and hitting famous departmental stores now light up with present boxes. Cheerful families could be spotted at Christmas-decorated galleries, Lafayette and Printemps department stores. Automated figures and colorful window displays are the center of attractions for them and their children. It's a season when people buy Christmas gifts for their loved ones and stores make big profits this time around. Many Parisians say they want to take advantage of this period as the government is debating whether or not to impose a COVID-related lockdown. In Venezuela, a large number of musicians are striving for one common goal, and that's setting the Guinness record as the world's largest orchestra. Over 12,000 musicians, mostly children and adolescents, have played together to make that happen. hundreds of violins, violas, and double basses playing in unison at this setting in Caracas. The musicians are all connected to the country's network of youth orchestras. For them to set a record, over 8,000 instruments had to play at the same time during a 5-minute period of a classical piece. Right now, a Russian orchestra that played the country's national anthem is holding the record. Once done, the crowd of musicians erupted in cheers, lifting their instruments and waving Venezuelan flags. Guinness will announce its decision in the next 10 days. Tourists and residents in Los Angeles have been mesmerized by a dazzling new event the U.S. city is hosting, with holiday-themed and full of colorful lights. Visitors can enjoy a mile-long walkway covered on all sides with brightly lit installations. Artists from around the world have taken part in the exhibition. The centerpiece display is a cathedral tunnel lit with thousands of bulbs. Another amazing attraction is the orbs, lit up with thousands of torches. The event has been a huge hit with the LA public.
Oh my gosh, it's so nice.
And it gets to be out in the open, and it's like a perfect night to do it, so it's great.
It's definitely the best. Like, we had to do, like, in a car to go see lights, and then we got to, like, now, like, go around and actually walk and get to see everything up close, which is super nice.
Yeah.
Definitely after the, what, year and a half that we've had.
Yeah.
So.
And it's really nice to see everything up close, because it's like, you see in a photo, but then it's more real and real, so.
Yeah.
The event opened to the public on the 12th of November and will run for 5 nights. Preparations for the event, however, started a month ago. The organizers say millions of bulbs and 17 miles of cables are used for the 18 art installations.
www.parstoday.com/en